jeans have given way to gaudy Hawaiian shirts and Bermuda shorts, and, in one case, short shorts. Well, Mike Rochburns always was one for bold fashion statements. Down at Budget Clones for You, the vats have started to sweat, and the staff are preparing to decant the latest batch a bit early. It's safe enough, but they do need a bit more looking after than they would if they went full term. To help with the early decant disorientation, each clone has been assigned to a staff member, or mummy, who will wipe runny noses, kiss the scrapes or bumps, and burp them after dinner. The green room has been converted into a clinic for those suffering the effects of heatstroke or sunburn. There was an overpowering cabbagey smell, but the techs couldn't find anything in the air fillers. In the end, floor mopping guy found one of Sandy's old thongs down behind a radiator. And now things are returning to normal. On the parade, McThargoids are selling their new summer range, including the Sausage McStiffy, Clownfish Fries, Parrot Poppers, and the ever-popular Tropical Tentacle Toasty. Gusto is half-cut on Malibu and making rude gestures at the man from Vista Genomics who wouldn't buy the mold he found inside his clown shoes. He's decided to keep the mold as a pet and named it Kevin. Some sunbathers have raised the blast shields on the sunny side of the station, which faces Proxima Centauri, and are tanning themselves on lilos they found in a cupboard. The radiation warning klaxon suddenly falls silent, and a voice announces,
"Our mics are live." Welcome, welcome to tonight's show. I'm Sandy Crevis, and I'm wearing budgie smugglers.
That can't be good for the poor budgie. I'm Wilma Fingadoo, and I'm wearing Factor 1000 sunblock, or, as some people call it, a spacesuit.
I'm Mia Harkness, and I am lurking in the shade with the cockroaches.
I'm Norma Snuckers, and I have crocheted a lovely summer parasol.
I'm Volcarius, and I'm resplendent in full Imperial Navy uniform, which has fans to blow cool air up my trouser legs. Breezy.
Headlines time, please. Huttonist hedgehogs.
Security system strands security specialist securing security system.
Rampaging rovers rob residents.
Flossy flight flies in the face of danger.
I rummage through the poo bag hanging at head height that is this week's BGS.
In breaking news this week, Vantayern has made a discovery on a far-flung planet in the Ken-Yar system, a discovery which is small, spiky, and generally known for being extremely carefree. The creatures in question were native to Earth for many centuries, but not known for being migratory in any way. Begs the question, how? They would in certain climates spend prolonged cold spells curled up into a spiky ball, otherwise known as a fuck-off ball, with spikes ready to deter any wishful thinking footballer. In warmer times of year, in the seasonal parts of Earth's climates, these creatures would come out and bimble around, sniffing out food from such as lovely juicy worms. To be clear, we are talking about earthworms here, not the legendary June worms. They couldn't eat a whole one of those. The problem they had was that they would bimble and bumble around anywhere. Open spaces, gardens, remember those, roads, even airfields. During prehistoric times, roads were particularly problematic, as vehicles were entirely ground-based, and these stabby footballs just could not survive against the surface vehicles, and would pop in a similar way to the aforementioned balls. As a result, the Erinaceus europaeus began to die out in these regions. The spiny, carefree spike ball did, however, find solace in warmer climates by adapting its sleeping habits. This slight variant, you could think of it like a ship with a paint kit, would now choose to sleep when food was hard to find in dry seasons. Then during wet seasons, they would vacuum up all the available food from the surface where they continued to bimble, safe from land vehicles. We are, of course, talking about the humble hedgehog. But have you noticed something? They have a surprising similarity to us huttoneers. Like a hedgehog, when the environmental controls go on the blink, we have a sleep. Like a hedgehog, when food is scarce because the shipment is late, we have a sleep. Like a hedgehog, we bimble around and vacuum up every scrap of food going. Well, BCM's evidence of that. Like a hedgehog, we huttoneers don't have a great previous history with vehicles, such as yellow beepy cars. And like a hedgehog, we just bimble about doing stuff, remembering our old adage of the profit margins never mattered at all. We spoke to Commander Sinister Hedgehog about this and other similarities. He had this to say.
Identifying both as a huttoneer and a hedgehog, I can agree the similarities are clear and obvious. In my own example, ferrying crew and guests to ECM in previous years, I can confirm the commander's inability to navigate ground vehicles, the need to sleep and eat. But as for the profit margins, well, I never took a penny, so it seems legit. Oh, by the way, anyone got any worms?
After the sinister hedgehog snuffled his way out of studio, it left Vantayan with an idea. Why not introduce the hedgehog, the Erinaceus europaeus, the foot-abusing spike ball, to Hutton Orbital? There are enough bug infestations to keep them alive for centuries. Everyone wears mag boots, so feet are safe. And with Hutton Station not having any yellow beepy cars, they all turned grey and melted, the friendly little Caltrops would also be safe from ground vehicles. Current favourite names for the sanctuary are Hot Hog, Worse Than Lego, Hog Heaven, Mrs. Tiggy Winkles, and Bimble Bonanza. But viewer suggestions are also welcome. These similarities are astounding, and we expect the introduction of hedgehogs to the orbital to be a beautiful collaboration of commanders and little spiky pals. And we cannot wait for the carefree critters to bimble around Hutton.
Wait, Vantayan, how do they cope in zero-G?
There was a minor panic in the control room this week after the station's automated gun platforms spread in a perimeter around the orbital, inexplicably fell offline. Hutton security chiefs dispatched a waiting Viper patrol craft for a quick investigation of the platforms in an effort to discover the source of the problem, and patrols were stepped up in case it was a precursor to an invasion or scurrilous attack on security systems at the orbital. Investigations determined that the little automated laser platforms had decided that they needed a patch, contacted manufacturers' servers and performed an upgrade and reboot, which wasn't a feature anyone realised they had. To be fair, the turrets spend most of their time defending passing traffic from drifting canisters of gin and mugs, the byproducts of Hutton truckers not remembering to do their teabagging outside the litter-free zone around the station. Other than that, and the annual, "Oops, there's an asteroid heading this way," the guns haven't been fired in anger since the original mug run, defending traders bringing scrap to the orbital from passing pirates. However, the floating firing platforms decided all on their own that they were due a patch. The only problem was that it was delivered, not from the orbital nearby, but via long-range data squirt from the manufacturer, relayed via the nav beacon at Alpha Centauri A. Which meant the reboot took a little over 2 hours. Then it crashed. Then it did an auto recovery, followed by sitting at the "Are you sure?" screen. With no one sitting at the consoles, that would be very lonely existence, the Security Patrol Viper pilot was able to EVA over to the platform, blow dust off the keyboard, someone had forgotten to put it under a little plastic sheet, and push Y. At which point the platform rebooted, detected the unpiloted Viper drifting in front of it, marked it as a shipping hazard, and vaporized it. The pilot has called for assistance and in the meantime is helping himself to the emergency supplies cupboard full of tinned hot dogs and beans, warmed by a few blasts from his aphelion.
We are nearly at the 1,292nd anniversary of the Perseverance rover landing on Mars. And we've received worrying reports about the behaviour of it and its contemporaries. In an effort to keep themselves operating, the Martian rovers have been drawn to the suburbs of the Federation capital city Olympus Village, where they've been scavenging for discarded tech that they can use to replace worn or damaged parts. One resident said,
"They're at the bloody bins every night. Curiosity found a half-eaten kipper the other night and decided that it was a life form. Have you heard of a 21st century rover loudly declaring it has found life on Mars at 3 in the morning? It sounds like a ZX Spectrum having a sneezing fit. I couldn't sleep with that going on."
Never mind that we're in the middle of a very large city full of humans and Mars has been terraformed for years, Curiosity decided it wanted to make first contact with a half-eaten smoked fish.
"They're breeding too. I've seen little ones with... They've even resurrected Beagle 2, although it doesn't call itself Beagle 2 anymore. It insists, in a very loud voice, that it is Johnny 5 and that it is alive. I know they're a protected species or whatever and they're historical technology, but the Federation must be able to do something. Some of the dumber ones are falling into canals and they make the place look really messy."
This worrying behaviour is not limited to the rovers. Some of the satellites have also been playing up, swooping down on unsuspecting citizens to snatch technology right out of their hands. One angry Olympian told us that the Amal Hope probe, launched by the UAE Space Agency back in 2020, dove at her and stole a data slate she was working on. She ranted,
"I was in the park for a bit of air and decided to check my messages while I was there. Suddenly it went dark and the satellite thing dropped down and snatched the data slate right out of my hands. As it flew away, it got into a big fight with the Tianwen 1, the search for heavenly truth, and the dropped my slate. It smashed all over the path. While they were fighting, Mariner 9 came trundling out of a bush and hoovered up the bits. I thought it was going to steal money from my bank account, but the police said it was probably just after my chips."
The federal government said that as the probes and rovers are protected by international conservation legislation, there is very little they can do except move them to the other side of the planet and hope they don't find their way back.
The sky over the planet of death didn't look like a sky. It looked like a bruise. Flossie gripped the flight stick of the Caspian, her knuckles white. She had been there once before. A solo run that felt like a fever dream. It had been easy. Too easy. That was the siren song of a white dwarf system. The beauty masks the teeth. "You sure about this?" Robbie asked from the co-pilot seat. He was trying to sound casual, but his eyes were locked on the massive, shimmering jets of the white dwarf star looming ahead. "It's a breeze, Robbie. Just quick hop for materials," Flossie lied, mostly to herself. As they dropped out of supercruise, the ship groaned. The gravitational shear of a white dwarf isn't a nudge. It's a violent tug of war with physics. The cockpit alarms began a low rhythmic pulse, the heartbeat of a ship under duress. "Deploy the SRV now," Flossie shouted over the screech of protesting hull plates. Robbie scrambled, his fingers slick with sweat, fumbled over the deployment sequence. On the heads-up display, the ship's integrity began to tick down. It's 98%, 96%. Robbie, the heat! We're cooking! The White Dwarf's radiation was sandblasting the shields. Every second Robbie hesitated, the Caspian moved a step closer to becoming a floating tomb. Finally, with a mechanical thud, Robbie's SRV dropped into the bay. Flossie slammed her own deployment switch, falling away from the ship just as the internal temperature hit critical levels. "Dismiss the ship," she barked into the comms. They watched from the jagged, scorched ground as the Caspian ignited its thrusters and vanished into the haze of the upper atmosphere. Flossie felt a cold spike of fear. If that ship didn't survive the automated climb, they were dead men walking on a rock that didn't even have the decency to provide air. They stepped out of the rovers for a split second to plant a beacon. "Flossie, look at the HUD," Robbie whispered. Their health bars were plummeting due to the intense heat. They scrambled back into the SRVs, the pressurized cabins hissing shut just in time. "We wait," Flossie said, her breathing heavy in her ears. "We gather what we came for, and we wait for the show." For the next hour, they became ghosts in the machine, driving their rovers across the obsidian plains, blasting mineral outcroppings to distract themselves from the ticking clock. Then it happened. The White Dwarf began its transit. It rose over the horizon like a god of cold fire. The sky turned a blinding electric violet. The horizontal light caught the dust kicked up by their wheels, turning the entire valley into a cathedral of shimmering radiation. It was the most beautiful thing Robbie had ever seen, and it was actively trying to kill him. "The safe window opens in 10 minutes, Flossie announced. The magnetism in the air made her voice crackle with static. This was the gamble. To leave, they had to recall the ship. If it returned crippled, they wouldn't have the thrust to break orbit. If it arrived too early, the star would melt its drives. Recalling now, a speck appeared in the purple haze. The Caspian descended like a falling blade, landing with a heavy thud that sent a shockwave through the ground. Flossie sprinted her SRV into the bay, her heart hammering against her ribs. She slammed into the pilot seat and ran a lightning-fast diagnostic. Hull, 88%. Internal modules, nominal. "We're clear," she yelled, punching the vertical thrusters. The planet fought to keep them, its gravity a heavy hand on their shoulders, but Flossie didn't let up. They punched through the orbital ceiling, the violet hell fading into the black velvet of deep space. As they docked with the carrier, the silence of the hangar was the loudest thing they'd ever heard. Robbie finally unbuckled, shaking. "Tomorrow?" he asked, his voice trembling with a mix of terror and adrenaline. Flossie grinned, wiping sweat from her brow. "Maybe. Let's see if the ship stops glowing first."
Welcome to this week's Hutton BGS bit, where we rummage through the cesspit that is the Bubbles background simulation in the hopes of finding something shiny. There is Warren LaSalle 8760 this week as Hutton battles against the Equestrian Naval Fleet. Should be easy enough. Have you ever seen a horse in a spacesuit? And there's another war in LFT 142 where Hutton is up against Azimuth Biotech. Outbreaks this week are in Epsilon Indy and Scilitar. Barnard Star is still in that investment phase, and Wolf 1061 sees us in an election with the elite rebel force. Wolf 359 is experiencing both boom and infrastructure failure. But then you wonder, what does it all mean? Well, if you want to shoot it, then get yourself across to LaSalle 8760 or LFT 142 and shoot it on Hutton's behalf. If you want to truck it, then I would suggest a little trip to Scilitar or Epsilon Indy, where medical supplies will fetch top prices. Or you could bring in machinery and food to Wolf 359. And if you want to do a bit of mission running, then Wolf 10. And if you want to do a bit of mission running, then go to Wolf 1061 and help Hutton with the election. This is Mia Harkness, Hutton BGS Bit, signing off.
Well then.
Well then.
Welcome to the show, everybody.
I made the scene. Did you hear it?
I made a scene.
No, I didn't hear a thing. Didn't hear a thing. Maybe should put my headphones on.
Yeah. I didn't make a scene because you gave me a double window and I actually opened two windows to read that.
A double window? What's a double window?
So I don't have to scroll. This way.
Ah, okay. Fair enough. Fair enough.
It's cheating.
Ah, well, as long as it all works out in the end, that's all we're after.
Indeed. You could have just turned your monitor sideways anyway.
So I'm assuming there hasn't been anything from Frontier this week.
There's been two Galnet articles, but they haven't announced anything on Forum X, anything like that. So
I don't think, even for them, I don't think the hangover is going to last this long.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, they can't put it away down there. They've got a space bar, you know.
Oh, God, right. Next! But even Tish, I'm shouting Aardvark on that one.
So, yeah, no great news there.
Yep, okay, that's fair enough.
I think the closest we've got to real news this week is the hedgehog invasion.
Yeah, hedgehogs, fantastic, though. I didn't know you get hedgehogs in Africa.
No, nor did I, but apparently so. Our intrepid explorer has reported back.
He has. He hasn't sent us pictures yet. We get pictures of a big crab. And something else. What was the other thing?
Scary lizards.
Scary lizard. Oh, the lizard looked amazing.
Yeah.
Scary lizard.
He very specifically didn't send us pictures of the viper that was hanging around in the tree just outside his little
You see, it's a viper. Was it or was it not a brown mamba?
I have no idea what it was.
Possibly one of the deadliest snakes in the world.
Mm-hmm. All I know is that he was advised not to take photographs whilst running away from the tree it was in.
Yeah, that's fair.
Good advice. Yeah. The local professional snake wrangler was called.
Yes.
And happily nobody was hurt.
A man with a stick in a bag.
That's the one, yeah.
Yes. It's definitely a mamba. I'm looking to see if it's a brown or black mamba.
How can you tell if we didn't get a picture? It could have been a Vince Green Viper.
He just said, "I'm Amber." Yeah. Just said about making a break for it and getting a little bit bitey. Okay. Yeah. I think mambas are like one of the two most poisonous, most venomous snakes in the world.
Yes, they very much are unpleasant things to be bitten by.
Yes.
So don't blame him for that one. Yeah.
Yeah, no, don't blame him at all. That's absolutely fine.
Yeah.
Just run away from the massive snake. You don't need to be near that.
No.
So there we go. Yeah.
Honestly, it doesn't even have to be massive for me to want to run away from a snake. I'll quite happily run away from the small ones as well.
I would quite happily keep my distance from a snake and not worry about what kind it was.
Yeah, it's safest, I think.
I think so.
No Frontier live stream.
Very sad. Very sad. Yep. I hope we hear something from them soon.
Yeah.
Well, like I said, we had a Galnet article, which it something about Radicodia unica, and it sounds like it's possible to turn it into some sort of performance enhancer.
Right.
So that's, okay. It's a little bit tenuous.
It is glue. It
comes out as a little blue pill, yeah?
Yeah. Yes. We were thinking along the same lines there, Jim.
I think we might have been, yeah.
Yes. But there we go. So, yeah, let's hope that they do more with that. I would hate to think, oh, here's a commodity. You know, you kind of, even a rare, you kind of want to eat the story to come to something, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I kind of viewed it as possible foreshadowing about operations, like the content of the first one. But
yeah.
Again, we don't know anything about it yet.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, if all that drama happened and all those people went missing and locking at the system and all that, and it was just so that somebody could, I don't know quite how to word this, so you could swallow the pill and get a stiff neck, then, you know, that seems a bit of a then you kind of want it to be something.
Neck.
Well, yeah, if you don't swallow it, probably,
she's being polite.
I'm being, yes. So yeah, all that for a hard on. It seems a bit odd. So
I think,
yeah,
given that they're trees, I think the term is woody.
Yeah. Oh yes, a woody. Yes. So we'll need to see how that one pans out. I think there might be more to it than that, you know. So yeah, maybe it turns everybody into raging zombies. It takes it. And then you put them in a forest of brain trees.
Oh yeah, maybe that's it. That they're the baby brain trees.
That makes sense. Yeah. So yeah, that's that anyway. But
yeah,
I suppose we should look and see if there's space news this week.
Ooh, space news.
Yeah.
Space news.
I gotta live vicariously through space news because I never see anything.
Sorry, Amelia, you were mid-sentence there.
I said I got to live vicariously through space news because I never bloody see anything.
I'm in Scotland. I never see anything either.
Well, this one's got a live stream that you can watch it do nothing on, sir.
Oh, wow. How cool is that?
Wow. That's awesome.
So this is Artemis 2 that they've put on the launch pad ready to go.
Ooh, that's a big one.
Yeah, this is a whopper. They did. I remember I looked on the telly. I was watching on the telly when they were doing it, and it was as if they were showing you this thing moving along, and it takes, I think it goes about a third of a mile an hour. It takes 12 hours to travel 4 miles.
Yeah.
To the launch pad, and they're cutting to this thing as if you're going to see something different, and then cutting back to a press conference with the astronauts stood outside, and you can see it in the background, very, very, very slowly trundling along, and I was like, oh my God. But see, the bit I never understood is how they get it from the vehicle onto the launch pad. Because, you know what I mean? Because they take it out in this vehicle, they don't take the whole, it's not the launch pad that drives it, is it? It's on the back of a thing. And then
it's
somehow.
The back of the big crawler.
Yeah, so this onto the.
It's a very good question.
The surface, and I don't know how they do it, and that's the part that's been annoying me for about a week now.
Have you tried asking one of those silly AI things?
No, I haven't bothered to Google it yet. I like the feeling of not knowing something, although I have the world's. The sum total knowledge of human history at my fingertips. I'm not going to use it because I'm feeling contrary.
Probably wise.
Yes. So there we go. So yeah, so that's on the launch pad. It's ready to go. And I think that mix might be, is it the 5th they're still talking about? I don't think it's been put back, has it?
They haven't put it back yet, but...
Yeah, but a lot can happen in the next few days.
But yeah, there's the link in chat to the NASA live stream, which is basically just staring at it on the pad. But hey, nothing wrong with that.
Aye, so it's scheduled to go on the 5th of February at some point.
They've still got the full wet run to do first, haven't they?
Yeah. And for anyone who's wondering why this one's particularly important, it's because it's going to go around the moon and do tests for the landing in Artemis 3. So it's going to do orbits of the moon. They're going all the way out to the back of the moon and then coming back again, sort of thing. So it'll do a few orbits of the moon and then make its way back. And I think they're going to be the furthest away from Earth any astronauts ever travelled, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So they're going to run into what we know as dark side of the moon, which isn't really dark. It's just the side that we never see from far. The far side of the moon, I think, is the best way to describe it. Right? Yeah. So, yeah, they're going to begin running that, and I think they're going to be taking some photographs and things.
Given that this is Hutton, I'd have thought you'd call it, you'd have said back instead.
Yes, I...
The back
the far side of the back.
The back side. No. Yes. The back side of the far side of the moon. It's just, it's got a massive valley that runs vertically. They call it the cleft. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I actually looked in it's part of this news, they were showing you the inside of the capsule. And it actually looked quite big and a bit roomy, just not in a way that you'd want to spend, like, is it 9 days or something?
Yeah, inside 1 to 2 weeks.
Yeah, just 2 weeks.
Just think of it as an English caravanning holiday in a touring caravan in Wales where it's piddling down with rain all week so you can't go out.
Oh, it's much bigger than that. So, yeah.
When you've got three kids with you.
Yeah, oh, yeah, okay. Okay. Or Father Noel Furlong.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So, yeah, this moon is small, but the one out there is far away.
That's the one.
So that's it. So, yeah, Artemis 2 is sitting on the launch pad, not yet delayed, almost ready to go.
Nice.
And the next one is quite interesting.
Would be if it would let me change page.
Oh.
Come on, you can
have
do
to
it.
Do a not now to subscribing and things like that.
All right, there we go.
And this is about an ex-Google CEO who, with a group of other people, is going to fund a space telescope that they're saying is a replacement. Some are saying replacement for a Hubble. Others are saying bigger than Hubble. So they're going to pop a space telescope up there. And I think, like Hubble, it'll deal mostly in the kind of the visible spectrum. So, but James Webb telescope gets into the infrared and ultra infrared. This will be visible spectrum, as far as I can tell. I'm just looking to see if it mentions it.
Not sure it's been definitively settled yet.
Yeah.
But it's certainly going to be not far off visible.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's planning, is it three telescopes, two ground-based, one space-based?
Yeah. Which would be amazing.
It would be fantastic if it ever happens.
I just wish they had a way to bring Hubble back, because it's been such a historic thing, you know?
Why bring it back? It's still working. It's still running.
Yeah. Leave it up there if you need to bring it back. Yeah. Still what? Still does stuff. So, yes, you know, that's the next one. And that's going to be private people building that one.
Yep.
I don't know if there's much else to see apart from that.
No, but it's nice.
Well, there's a lot to see, but there are too many stars in the way. Classic case, Sagittarius A star.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because that does make everything else look a bit kind of...
Yeah, looking at all the stars would be fantastic if it wasn't for all the stars in the way.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't want to look at the ordinary ones, so they're just a bit boring.
Next
is Mitsubishi are getting involved in a space station. They're calling it Starlab. And so their Starlab are going to announce this new lab in space, this new space station. And they're buying some of the capacity on the station. So this is like private industry buying space on a space station, if you know what I mean. They're calling it capacity, but we know what they mean. And that let them do like research work and things like that up there. So I'm assuming as well that that is going to be, they will be flying astronauts up there to do work, or, you know, this is all quite interesting.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, so, it's nice to see that private space is actually starting to fund itself properly, in the sense that there are people signing up to do experiments on the proposed private space stations that are going to replace the ISS in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting as well that space stations are becoming normal kind of that way as well, you know.
Well, we've had continuous presence in space since, what, 20 odd years now?
Yeah.
Nearly 30 years, I think.
Thing is, a lot of space exploration, you know, I mean, a hefty chunk of space stuff at the moment is privately funded, you know, like Elon Musk and whatnot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How close are we to getting like a Coriolis?
Would it help if I told you that the ISS could almost land on a medium pad?
How close are we to getting a Coriolis?
Not very close.
We're very far. What, 4, 5, 6 orders of magnitude away?
Yeah, I'll be fine. I mean, you might get a hot orbit sometime soon.
Just half a dozen? We're almost there.
Yeah, exactly.
Almost. Yeah. So if you stick 6 International Space Stations together, you just call it a Coriolis.
No. Orders of magnitude. But nice in theory.
I know.
Yeah. If it wasn't for the solar panels, you could literally land the ISS on a medium pad. But you'd have to fold one side in.
Okay. So that's helpful to know.
Just give you a sense of scale, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, but you might get a hot in orbit, though.
True.
I don't know. I mean, Coriolis might not be that far away when you think about it. I mean, take into account, like, how quickly technology is moving currently.
Yeah.
And how quickly we've progressed in the past, I don't know, 200 years.
Yeah.
You know, we've went from horse-drawn carriages to rockets.
Yeah.
In the past 200 years.
We've gone
computers and rockets.
Horse-drawn carriages to independent rovers running around on the surface of another planet.
So, I mean, if we keep progressing, I mean, I know it seems like we're stagnating right now, but, you know, with the possibility that we could keep progressing, it might not be that far away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the infrastructure to build it, I think, is the big thing.
It's also because we keep messing ourselves up with, like, you know, bigotry, racism, war, greed, late stage capitalism. There's a lot of things holding us back.
Yeah, and everybody's, there still isn't just one big space program, so it's still, the resources are still split. You know, China's got a space program. Europe's got a space program, America's got a space program, and
Japan, India,
the United Arab Emirates we mentioned earlier.
Imagine what we could do if we actually worked together.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. That we don't pool the resources, so, you know, you don't get the and best that, people.
I think that is why it doesn't seem very likely that it will happen quickly, because we won't work together.
Yeah. But then, if you think about it, I mean, you've then not got the best minds in one place. They're kind of scattered, you know. So maybe India's got a couple, and, you know, Russia's got a couple, and the US have got a couple. But,
the flip side of that, though, is you get competition. And when you get competition, you get people actually trying harder.
So. Yeah.
But, I mean, what, last show before, we were talking about somebody's plans to build a hotel on the moon.
Yes.
Which is going to require some fairly major infrastructure to get that up and running.
Oh, yeah.
and would also probably be a far more sensible place to start getting the materials together to build a Coriolis than Earth. We've got this nasty gravity well in the way that makes it very expensive to launch stuff from here. Be much cheaper to get materials for it from the moon or a passing asteroid or something like that.
And that's, I suppose that's the thing we're launching for the moon as well, is you've got a lot less gravity and you don't have the friction for the air.
Much, much lower delta V requirements.
Yeah.
Actually, there was an interesting article that didn't make it into the news this week, that Nancy Grace Roman telescope is just going online at the moment, the asteroid spotter.
Yeah.
I think I got the right one there. Could be Vera Rubin, can't remember, I've gone blank. One of those two telescopes is just in the process of going online, Earth-based one. And it hasn't yet fully gone online, but it did release its first batch of data, which was something like 38,000 images.
Wow.
This thing's a busy little bee. And they were focusing on known asteroids just for calibration data. And because they're taking such fast exposures and so many of them, they were able to get some really precise rotational velocities for these asteroids. Now, most asteroids spin at the rate of something between a couple of hours per rotation and days or longer per rotation.
Yeah.
They found a couple, actually a few tens of them, so not just an isolated event, that were spinning as fast as 1.5 minutes.
Okay.
And these are 500-meter class asteroids, which means that if you were on the surface, you would be experiencing minus 1/6 of a G.
And you'd be sick.
No, you'd be in space.
Yes.
You would. If you were in a cave on the surface, you would be standing on the roof of the cave, upside down, in roughly moon gravity.
That's amazing, isn't it?
If you just stick a toe track on the front, it's practically a Coriolis right there.
Yes, there you go. Problem solved, Amelia.
Problem solved.
But yeah, it's surprising a lot of scientists because they didn't think that many asteroids would have the structural integrity to spin that fast without, well, putting themselves into orbit and leaving. When your surface is going faster than your escape velocity, it has a habit of escaping.
Jesus, that's anyway, weird, doesn't it? But anyway.
Yeah. Moving on to story the fourth. What's this one about?
Yeah, full story. I'll do the title of that one. It's called Turn the Light Suit. So the plan has been submitted to build a new dark sky observatory in Scotland. I think it's the Galloway National Dark Sky Park, Scottish Dark Sky Observatory.
Can I just ask why there's a duck on the roof?
Oh, I see it. No, I do not know why that looks like a duck. Oh, do you know what it is? It's a door. Look,
it's duck.
A door of the big dome.
It's a duck.
It does look a bit like a duck, I have to say. I had been
looks like a duck, quacks like a duck.
Definitely so, a duck.
I think it's going to be in the, I think it's a Galloway Dark Sky Park or something like that.
They're even smoking the ducks, look.
So, yeah. Galloway Forest, so it's going to be down there, which is a natural kind of dark sky place anyway, so they'd built it in a good place. There was one, and it burnt down. I'd been to the one that was there before, and it was brilliant, because we were up on that roof, and they took us into the dome where that telescope is, and they shone it on, I think it was Vega. They had it shining in Vega, and you could see it as clear as a bell. It was amazing. And then, so you just go up and you wander a bit on the roof of the place. And they had like a telescope out there that was set up to look at Saturn as well. And it's the clearest image I've ever seen of Saturn. I say my own eyes, but through a mirror telescope. So it was good. And they had lots of wee bits and pieces in the centre downstairs. And they did presentations. And you like this, Jim? People brought their dogs in. So it's near Dalmellington down in Ayrshire, so it's at the kind of northern end of the Galloway that Sky's Park or Galloway Forest or whatever you want to call it, that gets down towards the borders with England. So it was a fantastic place, and it was a shame when it burnt down, but it looks like they're going to build a new one.
Super. So,
yeah. A wee Scottish wanty end there.
Nice.
Yeah. I think that's probably the last one, isn't it? Unless you know where you are, Jim. Yeah.
No, I think I'll do us for this week.
Okie dokie.
Do we have a word of the week?
We have a belter of a word of the week this week.
A belter?
A belter. Okay. Today's word, this week's word of the week is Dunfifpilot.
Dunfifpilot?
Dunfifpilot.
That sounds German.
It is German. It's a German word. It describes someone who is a screw-up, constantly makes a mess, or is incompetent. The literal translation is diarrhea pilot.
Are you flying again?
Can you use it in a sentence, please?
I can use it in a sentence. The Dunfifpilot tried to land his anaconda on the small pad at Hutton, then dumped his cargo all over the medium pad before hitting the waste tanks and crashing into the For the Mug beacon.
Now, see, that would have been far more impressive if you'd said the entire sentence in German.
Yeah, that wasn't going to happen. I might be able to do it in Welsh, but
we actually have a working headline today, so I'm going to plonk that there.
Yes. It's a great word. I discovered it last week, and I was like, oh, that's the best. I've just wanted to call people a diarrhea pilot all week. it's just it's descriptive. I think it brings vivid images to life.
It certainly does that.
Yes.
That is cool. I like that word.
Yep, that's a good one. So, I think, is it?
Is it that time?
Could it be? Is it?
Possibly.
Is it? I haven't heard the music
yet. Is it? Oh, yeah. Wait, what? No, we don't have that while Vantian is not around. Yes, is it time for the thing which happens to be present in Studio 6 to be handed over to the chat?
Very possibly.
Give them a minute.
There we go. Yeah. So,
anyone can post it.
I can't, but.
That's no excuse.
So, in the meantime, welcome to this show's quiz, which everyone's welcome to join over at quiz.inif.space in a browser window on the side or with a mobile device. This week it's all about speed, from every dolphin Dunfifpilot dropping out of the race to every hauler hooning canyon conqueror who needs replacement landing gear twice a day. Everyone listening live is very welcome to boost their enhanced performance thrusters over to quiz.inerv.space now or at any time during the quiz to join in. And remember, it's not a race to answer each question, but you do have a limited amount of time, so go ahead and pop a guess if Litho starts the countdown. And we have various competitors lining up at the start line. Very nice. Whoever managed to put dust on Dunfifpilot, very good.
Detonation in 10 seconds.
Sorry, just to encourage people to sign up.
Dark missed one then.
Yeah. The first question is, what is your name?
It isn't, although I could quickly add it.
What is
what
your quest?
Is your favourite colour?
I'll give it a few more seconds.
Yeah, there's no hurry. I was mostly checking the button worked.
Okay, I think we can begin.
What is the capital of Australia?
What? I don't know that.
In any case, round one is rambunctious racing. Question one. Which ship has the fastest possible boost speed? Now, I've given you a selection of the fastest ships. Most of them small ships, some of them medium. But is it the Adder, the Corsair, the Cobra Mark III, the Cobra Mark V, the Eagle, Imperial Clipper, Imperial Courier, Imperial Eagle, Mamba, Orca, or the Viper Mark III?
Remember to press post.
I did this time.
This is unmodified.
Oh, sorry. I should have clarified. No, that's very, very much modified. So it's as modified
as you can make it.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, well, then I don't know that.
I was waiting for someone to do that.
I knew the unmodified one.
I know the unmodified one. I put the unmodified one in.
I didn't say it might be the same.
No, you didn't. Maybe
just before the next question, I'm going to do a thing I totally forgot to do earlier, which was set the presenter mode on the presenter screen.
I see no seams.
There we go. Seamless.
Right, question two. Wait, did that work? Yes, it did. Good. Question two. Which ship holds the top speed bowling record? At least the top record I could... I'll explain it in a moment. So that's at least the top record I could find. So speed bowling, it's a fun little thing you can do with powerful thrusters around a high G planet. It uses gravity to build your velocity vector beyond the thruster speeds while using the thrusters to pull the direction back up. So that's speed bowling, and their commanders like to do it and attain absolutely silly speeds in normal flight. Which ship holds the top speed bowling record, do you think?
Yeah. Bowl refers to the shape of the crater you leave when you hit the surface.
Well, the really good ones land in a crater for additional time spent gaining speed to break the record.
At those speeds, I don't think you get much extra time.
Detonation in 10 seconds.
And question three. What is your favourite racing ship?
That's an easy one.
You've put them all in. I'm hoping they'll be named some of those.
You're hoping nobody what some of those?
Names some of those.
Nobody chooses them, yeah.
Yeah.
I bet I've got that one right.
Did you remember to...
Yeah, if you don't press post, you'll get it wrong.
That is true.
Detonation in 10 seconds.
And the results are... The fastest possible boost speed. It's actually two ships. It's the Viper 3 or the Imperial Eagle, although it's easier to do 932 in the Imperial Eagle. The Courier does get close. I did give a point for the Courier. It can get just under 900. But the top one is the Imperial Eagle or the Viper Mark 3.
Wow.
The Mamba holds the top speed bowling record. I'd imagine this is probably due to its incredibly good boost as opposed to any other property of it. It's the speed bowling. It's not about the thrust. Or it's the racing stripes. Yeah. The speed bowling is not about the actual thrusters giving you forward, because obviously the thrusters have a limit, but it's about the gravity gradually building your speed while the thrusters correct them. And the Mamba apparently has one of the best abilities to do that.
Interesting.
And that was, I forgot to mention the actual speed. It was 34,526 was the speed, meters per second, by a commander named Rift Fox. And it looks like most people like Imperial Eagles for racing, which is not surprising because they were one of the top possible boost speeds.
I don't care what anyone says. I will take an adder over an Imperial Eagle.
Well, the adder is actually the fastest boost speed you can get, which is around 750, while having a passenger seat.
And a cup holder.
There you go.
But they don't go south of the river at this time of night. Moving swiftly.
I don't know about the Panther Clipper, but fair dues.
At least nobody fastest said the racing. Anaconda.
Fastest racing with 1,000 cargo. Anyway, round two is Vociferous Velocity. Question one. In meters per second, what is the glide speed of a Caspian Explorer? That's with the Mark II ablative bulkheads.
I have no idea. So I'm just going to type boobs.
I can't even blame you for starting that. I know it was dead meat.
Well, no, I fly one, but I've never noticed things like that.
Never flown one? Quick, Flossie, get in game and have a check.
Well, I'm in game, but I'm on a carrier at the moment.
Excuses. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, your Caspian's out on distant cruises, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, distant worlds, yeah.
Distant cruisers. You'll get onto a big ship and sail around for a week.
I want to get to this waypoint, rendezvous point. We're starting our own ships.
Yeah, for a week. Then you get back on a big ship and sail around for another week. Think of it as shore leave.
Yeah. No, I just don't know. And I haven't got time to go out anywhere because we're going out the next waypoint soon.
True.
Next jump.
10 seconds. Now that everyone's had enough time to look that one up on the internet, question two. In meters per second, what is the terminal velocity of a ship in freefall?
Laden or unladen?
It doesn't matter.
I was just about to ask that.
That's with thrusters disabled, falling downward under gravity. And not in a Mamba that's doing the speed bowling, just falling.
Boo.
It's not a common thing to notice that there is actually a limit on how fast you can fall under gravity. If you don't know that, just take a random guess.
Detonation in 10 seconds.
Question three. In meters per second, what is the airspeed velocity of an unladen sidewinder?
African or European? Sorry, somebody had to ask.
A stock unladen sidewinder, and that's just the top boost speed of a stock sidewinder, which it barely reaches.
Oh, boost speed. Boost speed.
Yes, so the top boost speed of a stock sidewinder, which it barely reaches with the stock 1E distributor, but nonetheless.
Look at those classic retro colours in that image.
Space has always been black.
I'm talking about the Sidewinder.
Oh, right.
And we have, so 3,500 metres per second is the glide speed. The normal glide speed is 2,500, but with the ablative armour on the Caspian, it's 3,500. I gave a point for getting for 4,000 being relatively close. I just now noticed that 80,085 isn't the lowest answered item on that list. As in, more than one person did it.
When in doubt, people write boobs.
Mm-hmm.
Using numbers.
And 500 meters per second. So I gave a point for the closest answer on this one. If you just stop in orbital cruise, just drop from super cruise into normal flight, then turn off flight assist, turn off your engines.
Okay.
You'll start falling.
You know, that's technically not terminal velocity.
In the context that there isn't actually.
Because terminal velocity is a measured thing.
Well, it relies on there being a atmosphere, but the essence of the question is that there is a velocity limit, which just by space magic you don't exceed.
See, I have jumped out of a plane at 50,000 feet and hit terminal velocity. It's a very cool experience. I highly recommend it.
There you go. And
that's a hard no.
As for the Sidewinder, it's 308. Very well done, 320. That was actually a very close, so I gave full points for that answer.
Dog slow. Yeah, that's about right.
See, I don't know how slow dog slow is, though.
I guess it depends on whether it's Chihuahua or Greyhound.
Now, see, I almost put 300 as a guess from, you know, what I remembered back in the day when I first started the game and mucked around with the Sidewinder. And I put 400 specifically because I thought things might have improved since I was last in one.
No, same old board now. Okay. And we have one more round, which is ominous other stuff.
Ooh.
Question one. Why does the Vulture maintain high speeds during combat? Does it have better flight assist, good aerodynamics, high duration boost, large thruster class, low distributor penalty, or slow deceleration?
Multiple guesses, I do like them. Means you've got a chance of getting it right.
I do like multi-choice, but I am stuck over three different ones to choose from here.
Why limit yourself? I was stuck over five.
I'm guessing. I haven't flown a Vulture since... Oh, my God.
Sorry.
Ages.
Question two. Why can the Corsair reach top speed with thrusters downsized by two classes? So that's class 5 instead of class 7. Does it have an aerodynamic beak? Is it below a minimum mass? Is it because Gutermeier just does that? Is it a manufacturing error? Is it a powerful boost? Or is it the racing stripes? So the max speed of a Corsair, it's like 599. It's probably listed as 600, but I've only ever seen 599. But yes, you can achieve it with a class 5, not instead of the class 7.
But only with a tailwind.
It works in like an asteroid field where there isn't any tailwind.
Were you being towed by a pair of swallows?
A pair of sidewinders, yeah.
Detonation in 10 seconds.
And finally, in meters per second, what is the boost speed of your fastest ship?
I have no idea.
Me neither.
Well, you'd never press boost.
Not usually. I mean, I think it's around 800 or something, a type.
Don't look at it.
Type 9. I'm gonna guess at that. I don't fly many fast ships. I like the whole space whale experience.
Doesn't have to be fast. It could be 230 if that's the top speed.
There we go.
Detonation in 10 seconds.
Some of these will be 80,085, though.
We have. The Vulture has a low distributor penalty. It does have a large thrusters class, but that isn't why it maintains high speeds. In fact, having a large thrusters class, it doesn't actually give you more speed. Large thrusters just let you carry more stuff. The Vulture it loses almost no speed when you put everything into systems and weapons. So with nothing in engines, it retains 90% of its speed, which is the highest of any ship. So like if you go 4 to engines, you'll have 100% speed. You can take it all out of engines, you're at 90% speed. It's not particularly fast for a small ship. It's only 574 max. But yeah, it loses almost nothing. The second to that is the Fer de Lance at around 85% if you take it all out of engines. Which I didn't know this before looking all this stuff up. So I learned something.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
No, I did. I had no idea that, that ships. Uh-huh. Completely honest. I had no idea that different ships lost different amounts of velocity when you take their points out of engines.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Fine.
Sorry.
The Corsair is indeed, it's below the minimum mass of the thrusters. You can make it light enough to get, the way we know you hit maximum speed is when the mass is below the minimum mass number on the thrusters. Although Gutermeier does generally make very fast ships.
Yeah, I think that should be worth 1 point. Gutermeier just does that.
Oh, all right then.
And I didn't even put that, so.
There we go. You guys get a point.
And you get a point. And you get a point. And you get a point.
And you get a Corsair. And you get a Corsair.
And finally, we've got, we have both 800 and over 800. So that's two very distinct answers. We've got 750-ish, 700-ish, and 650-ish. Who is probably flying an Orca, a Mambra, or an Imperial Clipper, which would have been doing 642, like the other one. And if I can find it, I'll find the scoreboard. As Raphael, and indeed tied for first place with Das Stonefif Pilot with 13 points. We have third with Chunda, 11 points. And we have joint fourth with Bograt and Ooby Doop Scooby Dooby Banooby.
I have the silliest name in the galaxy. I think that's my highest ever score. Ever. I did not realize I got that many correct. Most of those were just guesses.
Yeah. Surprised I got six.
Yeah, normally I'm in the 2-3 range-ish. And that's only because of the generic questions like, what is your favorite ship? What is your fastest ship? And there's no wrong answer.
Yeah, there were two of them this week.
I could make them all that if you want.
But then everyone would get the same.
I don't know about that. But well done, everybody.
Yay. And thank you for the quiz.
Thank you. Yeah, that was cool. Yeah, it's always cool. I love these little quizzes.
And I really didn't know. I promise. I really didn't know.
Well, you did some great research. Which means
you learn something new every quiz.
But I need to find my buttons again. So we should be in there. And that means it's time to turn that off if I can find it, which would be there. And we're back to the time when we quite sensibly hand over to Flossie to find out the news of the week.
Yeah.
It's Flossie. And the community goes.
Hello, Flossie here with this week's CG News. I'm afraid there are no new CGs this week. Distant World 3 is coming to the end of the carrier phase as we approach Waypoint 1, Rendezvous Point, ready for the ship phase at the weekend. As of 2100 UTC, we were at Pua Plo VR-L A62-0, over 39,000 light-years from Sol, and over 3,900 light-years from Rendezvous Point, but we've made a few jumps since then, so distances have changed a bit. And then the real journey begins. And that's it for this week's CG News.
Flossie told you what to do.
So did you have fun at the World of Death, or whatever they called it?
Yeah, it was all right. Quite enjoyed it. So I went on one day myself, and then the next day I took Robbie along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we heard what happened the next day.
Yes, it's always better when you can terrify others.
Yeah, so it was quite interesting.
Yeah. Do you know, were there many casualties, or did people mostly survive the experience?
I heard of a few who got marooned there as didn't have an SRV and lost the ship or whatever. But,
oopsie.
Yeah. I think, people either escape from the menu thing.
Yeah.
Stuck recovery. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I didn't really hear firsthand of anything happening going wrong like that. No, we've just arrived in another system.
Ooh, nice.
Mm. Yeah. AUWSY something.
Mm. Yet another license plate.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to actually flying soon.
Mm. Yeah, it should be good.
Apart from looking around the systems we park up in.
I think it's been a really good idea the way they're doing it this time, though, with the fleet carrier or the squadron carriers taking people to places, alternating with.
Well, it means the starting point is way beyond Sagittarius A.
Yeah, and much faster than most people could have reasonably got there. So,
yeah, And goodness knows where we're going to end up. That will all be revealed in the future.
I'm sure they'll supply you with a map.
Well, we only get to know about the next waypoint each time. So it's all pretty hush-hush.
Keeps the griefers under control, which would be better than DW2 was.
We won't mention them.
Well,
I don't want to give them unwarranted airtime.
No. Well, I hope it's fun.
Yes.
But for now, let's find out whether Beetlejuice and Wotherspoon have got anything to delight and dazzle us.
Galnet News Update, 28th of January, 3312. Improved physical and mental performance for all humankind. That's what chemicals extracted from the blue trees of HIP 87621 might be able to offer, according to the first published analysis. In a bid to demonstrate its openness to scientific peer review, October Consortium recently handed over a carefully curated package of data about Radicoida unica to the Holloway Bioscience Institute, which has been commissioned to publish an initial analysis of the alien tree's genetics and practical potential. While Dr. Roy Casimir's report is light on detail, it indicates a strong potential for enhancing human physical and mental performance, while also suggesting that there may be some risks to exploiting the exobiological marvel. According to Casimir, Radicoida's cell structure adapts to that of nearby life, while the trees have a level of primitive awareness of nearby activity. The scientist did not suggest that Radicoida is sentient, but an alien plant that knows what you're up to sounds at least a little bit concerning. Casimir is excited by potential pharmaceutical applications. The flesh of the Radicoida's seed pods contains a compound that has been demonstrated in initial experiments to make laboratory mice stronger and more intelligent. This suggests similarities to the Thargoid's meta-alloys, which symbiotically repair and enhance damaged equipment. The doctor refers to, but does not enumerate, a list of possible uses for this curious compound. Lexi October published a press release to coincide with Holloway Biosciences' report, claiming that this sharing of data demonstrates that the Radicoida unica of HIP 87621 are in good hands. However, some commentators have suggested that Big Bill Ventura's unexpected reinvention as a health guru may be linked to secret human trials of drugs developed using the Radicoida compound, which might in turn suggest ethical issues in October's approach to their intellectual property. The seven powers remaining in the contest to control the supply of Radicoida unica remain in ceasefire, with no indication that any one power will ever have control over the supply of whatever miracle compounds the blue trees of HIP 87621 might offer up.
Do hope that wasn't Beetlejuice's ship that we saw sacrificed in the name of a news story there.
I don't think so. I think she's more careful than that.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. She'd send Wotherspoon. There's a crack of that, though, isn't it? Is it Ham City, I think it was called? It's the building at the moment. Actually, it's probably changed by now because it's Thursday, isn't it? So.
Yeah,
it may well have fixed its deployment issues.
I remember it was there was a port called like a Coriolis called, was it Michael City, and it had a outpost inside the docking area called German City.
Oh yeah, I remember that one.
They've been separated now, but it was quite fun. The fascinating discovery from those is that if you is whether you could dock at the outpost without incurring and trespassing from the starport, and it turns out you can. All you need is to have an open docking request, and then both ports say, "Oh, you must be docking." It's fine. Yeah. And you could, with the right timing, sneak onto one of the pads on the outpost.
Yeah, except there was a Red Planet taxi on it.
Needs to be a medium or a large pad for lads for a Red Planet taxi service.
They'll block anything if you give them the chance.
Yeah.
Well, so we don't have a rare this week.
We do not.
So guess
no.
That's the end of the show.
Oh no!
Oh no!
That just leaves us those three magical words to sign off with.
Get tea.
We've missed something.
Oh.
Oh, we have. Well,
it's Mr. Pond's birthday today.
Oh, yes. Of course.
Yes.
Why do you do this?
Because it's good.
Because we don't like ourselves very much.
that was far too close. So, everybody warm up. Me. And here we go.
Yo.
Happy birthday to you.
And many more.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Palantir.
People are shouting aardvark in the chat.
I thought that was a particularly beautiful rendition.
I think that was an extraordinary rendition.
Mm-hmm.
Seamless, you might say.
Mm.
Seamless.
All right.
Seamless.
That's it.
So I think that's finally it.
Yes.
I think so.
Anybody feeling
for the mug?
That's the one.
For the mug! Oh, it's that one.
Yeah. Journey too long. Cargo too small. Profit margins never really mattered at all. We're gonna take the cargo where it's needed today. Super cruising all across the Milky Way. We're taking anything, anytime, anywhere. Loading all the teenage to the brim with the rest for the more.
For the more.
For the more.
For the more.
Yeah, you know just where we're coming from. For the more.
For the more.
For the more.
For the more.
Yeah, everybody's seen the trucker song. Flossie always seems to crash into the sun. Skibble ice, the pilot on the Xbox One. Helping out the free, you know who leads us well. Trucking across the galaxy, now everybody yell. For the more,
for the more,
for the more,
for the more.
Yeah, you know just where we're coming from. For the more,
for the more,
for the more,
for the more.
Everybody's seen the hunting trucker's song. For the more,
for the more,
for the more.
For the more.
You know just where we're coming from. For the moth,
for the moth,
for the moth,
for the moth.
Everybody sing the choker's song. Give me a large pipe that I can land on, and I'll give you cargo and sing you my song. No point 22 light years to go, cruising to work, no journey too long, no cargo too small. The profit margins never really mattered at all. Gonna take the cargo where it's needed today. Super cruising all across the Milky Way. We're taking anything, anytime, anywhere. So shout it out loud, like you don't even care. For the moth,
for the moth,
for the moth,
for the moth.
Yeah, you know just where we're coming from. For the moth,
for the moth,
for the moth. Everybody sing the trucker's song. For the moth,
for the moth,
for the moth,
for the moth.
Yeah, you know just where we're coming from. For the moth,
for the moth,
for the moth,
for the moth.
Everybody sing the trucker's song.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of the show. Everyone's buggered off now, so why don't you bugger off too?
Seamless.